Welcome to the Manoa 100 Centenary Podcast, part of the Decade of Centenaries program. In this, the sixth and final in our series, we are marking Ireland's formal accession to the League of Nations. What did it mean for Irish men and Irish women? On the 10th of September 1923, the President of the Executive of the Irish Free State, W.T. Cosgrave, was in Geneva, Switzerland. The acceptance of the Irish Free State into the League of Nations was reported back home by the Freeman's Journal. Its front page headline read, "The Dream of Emmet." Beneath it, "Ireland taking her place among the nations of the earth." And then a third sentence, words written in bold. One can almost hear it as if it were three beats of a drum. And then a fourth, "Irish flag at Geneva, the flying of the tricolour." You would barely notice the Irish flag flying from public buildings today, except perhaps when it flies at half mast. So often in this decade of centenaries, at state ceremonials, the flag was raised and lowered, acknowledging those who gave their lives in the years of war in Ireland. During the campaign of independence and during our civil war. Those events of those seminal years, 1912 to 1923. So now we reflect on the Irish delegation gathered in Geneva for this moment when Ireland was invited to join the League of Nations. The founding document, the Covenant of the League of Nations, was drafted during the peace negotiations at the end of the Great War, what we now know as the First World War. The Covenant contained the main principles on which the League was built. A new era of multilateral cooperation had begun.
Geneva was to become the clearinghouse for the agreements and disagreements of the world.
There's an early recording captured on a Visitone Marconi, a process for electric recording on gramophone discs. It is preserved in the archives of the British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC, and dates to 1920, the year of this organisation's beginning.
Behind this broadcast is the story of an ancient city and a new political ideal. Geneva was the haughtiest city of Switzerland, itself the most nationally aloof of European countries. Yet, because of its steadfast neutrality, it has become the main base of international discussion. After the war fever of 1914 to 1918, followed a drive for peace. The forces of cooperation organized themselves.
When the Irish delegation arrived, the Press Association foreign correspondents reporters were present. Ireland had presented guarantees and credentials that satisfied the political commission that assessed their application. There was not the slightest objection to the admission of the Irish Free State. However, Abyssinia was refused until such time as their government could give guarantees on slavery.
In 1919, the International Labour Organization began work. A draft covenant was adopted by 42 states. On the 15th of November 1920, the first assembly of the League of Nations was held in Geneva.
All smaller projects were merged in a larger and more ambitious scheme, President Wilson's League of Nations.
In 1919, less than 4 years earlier, Ireland, fighting for its own self-determination, had sought recourse to the League of Nations. In 1923, Ireland was invited to be part of the League of Nations. However, it was a partition country, with political prisoners still in jail, with an uneasy and uncertain peace. It was a mere 4 months after Frank Aiken had given the message to dump arms, the symbolic end for the Civil War. Indeed, the application to join predated the cessation of fighting and Frank Aiken's order. In 1923, President Cosgrave's speech was reported in the Ballymena Observer, "In the name of God, to this assembly of the League of Nations, life and health. We are the delegates of Saoirse Éireann, its parliament and government. who come to declare to you that Stairsort Éireann desire to acquire a membership of the League and to participate in the great work of the League. We thank you, and we pray that our peace and friendship may be everlasting. It is just discernible in the reports that W.T. Cosgrave was a bit awed by what he had encountered. Imagine he had been a minister in an underground government who had fought a campaign for independence. And here he was, 4 years later, president of the Executive Council of the Irish Free State. Early transmissions from Geneva convey something of the complex nature of the operation and apparatus of communication from the League 100 years ago.
The League is in session. Today's events have international importance. The BBC observer at Geneva rings up Broadcasting House. He gives them details on which they plan his evening broadcast. The BBC calls Post Office Headquarters. Headquarters inform the International Exchange.
Hello, yes. Now, the BBC want to broadcast from Geneva directly after the second news bulletin. Yes. We'll use the Geneva Lyons Paris Underground Circuit extended to London. Yes, all right. I'll phone Paris and ask them to arrange accordingly.
The success of this broadcast depends on the post office. Spread out across Europe is a network of post office landlines. The broadcast will be relayed through this landline to the BBC for transmission. One after another, 6 control stations connect the sections of the line, until the circuit between the League and the BBC is complete.
When questioned by reporters in Geneva, the president of the Executive of the Irish Free State was asked if he saw favourable results from a political and commercial point of view. He replied, "Ireland will derive great benefit from joining the League. I have seen nothing that would justify me in coming to any other conclusion." So what was this dream of Emmet? Was it Ireland's place among the nations of the earth?
I have but one request to ask at my departure from this world. It is the charity of its silence. Let no man write my epitaph. For as no man who knows my motives dare now vindicate them, let not prejudice or ignorance asperse them. Let them and me repose in obscurity and peace, and my tomb remain uninscribed until other times and other men can do justice to my character.
Thomas Emmet, descendant of Robert Emmet's older brother, Thomas Addis Emmet, reads those words. The readers of Irish newspapers 100 years ago were asked to think of the words of the eloquent patriot Robert Emmet. Not his failed rebellion against the newly established Act of Union that formed the United Kingdom of Britain and Ireland, but rather his speech to his contemporaries in 1803. There are believed to be over 70 different versions of the speech. So you could say it went viral 220 years ago.
The caveat that everybody puts in to the Emmet quote about taking place among the nations of the earth is really 26 counties, Irish Free State, as opposed to an all-Ireland. And I think, yes, that's there. But let's look at the glass half full as opposed to the glass half empty in this.
That's Professor Mary Daly, who has been a member of the government's expert advisory group on the decade of centenaries since it was set up over a decade ago.
What's really important about the League of Nations and the International Labour Organization, and Edward Phelan, who was the chief legal counsel in the ILO, was the one who helps Ireland by saying, you need to ratify all these conventions, you need to sign up as the Irish Free State. Britain was trying to say, oh, we'll, don't worry, boys, we'll do it for you, we'll sign for the British Commonwealth or the British Empire. The fact that Britain ratifies, well, that's fine, Britain ratifies for Britain. Britain is not ratifying for the Irish Free State. So it is a place where the new Irish government can assert itself in a polite and forceful manner to show we're not an appendage of Britain, we're not an appendage of the British Empire. We are an independent state and we will act accordingly in an international forum. And that message, getting that message across to all the other countries that are part of both the ILO and the League of Nations, I think was very, very important. When the Irish Free State is looking for role models or exemplars of what it's going to do in somewhere like the League of Nations, Canada is the number one, really. They look to a lesser extent to Australia, but Australia is much more deferential to Britain than they are. And so they are benchmarking themselves against what could be referred to as the White Commonwealth, if in many ways, the First Nations in both Australia and in Canada. So I think they see themselves as on a par.
In the palace is a special post office where as many as 20 bags of mail come in and go out every day. The League has branch offices and correspondents all over the world. Communiques and pamphlets are always being sent out. Reports are always arriving.
Members' contributions are fixed by the Assembly in gold francs, according to an estimate of their ability to pay. Mr. Seymour Jacqueline, Treasurer, receives the money.
Have you the file on the Swiss government's contribution? I see they have paid for this year.
They have paid as usual at the beginning of the year, the sum of 489,000 francs.
Thank you.
If the League is to fulfil its object, it must get the people of all nations thinking internationally. Its deliberations must be open. It needs publicity.
I went to the ILO and I found it a bit overwhelming, and I was a man in my mid-20s.
Francis Devine, Labour historian, who was also a member of the government's expert advisory group on the decade of centenaries. He was a delegate to the International Labour Organization in his 20s.
It's quite hard to imagine how just psychologically that must have been a big, big, big thing for them to arrive into this thing with world leaders and, well, ministers for this, that and the other and significant trade union figures. What I found in the ILO was the building is now two buildings like that. And this corridor is 400 metres long. It's often used in films, which are, endless. We started work at 8:30 and didn't finish until 6:30 because most of it was done in discussion in committees. So it was pretty intense. The International Labour Organization was formed, if you like, within the framework of what the League of Nations was attempting to do, which was, of course, to maintain world peace, to prevent future wars, and to create and facilitate the conditions that hadn't led to conflict in the first place and wouldn't lead to conflict in the future.
We have to see the ILO coming out of some of the international workers' movements that are there from the 1890s and meeting. Bear in mind as well that in the 19th century, you do get factory acts and legislation introduced to protect women and children. And some of the very first professional women civil servants working in Ireland, and this is under the British system, were factory inspectors, factory and workshop inspectors. They went in and checked on conditions in what we'd regard as sweatshops nowadays and in factories to make sure women were not being exploited. So you inherit, the Irish Free State inherits that whole legislative programme, which is determined to protect women, protect them from night work, protect them from unhealthy occupations. And this is part of the inheritance of the Irish Free State, the legislative inheritance of the Irish Free State from Britain.
W.T. Cosgrave spoke to the Assembly in both Irish and English. He headed a delegation of 9 men from Ireland. Scanning a photograph of the Assembly dating to September of 1923, I see the audience is largely made up of white men. Only some women are visible in the body of the room. In the observation balcony, many women are present. To modern eyes, it is not a representative body.
But it might be worth recording the fact that Ireland was the first, shall we say, post-colonial country to be represented. That we were in a situation where obviously most of the world in Africa and Asia was still under colonial rule. Maybe a criticism that I've personally always had of Ireland, and I continue to have this criticism today, is that Ireland, having broken from the British Empire, didn't choose diplomatically in other ways to give leadership to others that might follow that path. And if you think of today with the places like Ukraine, the options for countries like India and Ireland, who were always presented on left-wing papers at the time as two ends of the same spectrum against British imperialism, are not taking a lead as non-imperialist, post-imperialist nations to offer an alternative path. So I don't think that was reflected, particularly in the ILO, partly because the representatives of those workers in colonial countries did not have direct representation because they didn't have direct governments.
I think the other point to bear in mind is in those years, the League of Nations' role vis-a-vis colonies is there are mandates, but they are still under colonial government. You don't have India at this table. You don't have any part of Africa at that table except South Africa. So really the benchmarks are a white Commonwealth, the other dominions, and the other benchmark, of course, are the new countries, Czechoslovakia, you know, the Baltic states, who are also coming in from having been part of bigger European empires.
The Irish Free State delegation were not the only Irish in Geneva in September of 1923. Suffragette, campaigner and vocal opponent of the Irish Free State, Hannah Sheehy Skeffington was also there. We know she was in the city because she wrote a letter objecting to Ireland entering into the League of Nations. It does suggest that she had travelled there as she wished to meet in person. Did this fail and she had to resort to writing a letter, which we can now find in the archive of the League of Nations? Hannah wrote in her capacity, as she described herself, as a delegate of the Irish Republic, proclaimed in 1916. Although she claimed that her position was ratified by two subsequent elections, she had never been elected to Dáil Éireann. But clearly, she was representing alternative Irish voices. She asked the League to consider that they were giving a place to Ireland based on insufficient data. She said the Irish nation had not been consulted on the question, that the Irish Free State did not represent the whole of Ireland, and that both the treaty and the constitution had been forcibly imposed. Hannah Sheehy Skeffington had the death mask of Robert Emmet on her mantelpiece. She had saved it from destruction during the War of Independence by hiding it from the Black and Tans, as she told Orem Fox. Her house was raided constantly on Belgrave Road, Rathmines, dubbed Rebel Road. She certainly did not see this as the dream of Emmet. In 1923, it was 120 years since the 25-year-old orator had made his famous speech from the dock. I travelled to Altidore Castle during Heritage Week 2023 as the Emmet family opened their doors of their home and their private museum. There I met Philip Emmet, six generations away from Thomas Addis Emmet and his son Thomas.
Welcome to Altidore Castle. I'm Thomas.
I'm Philip Emmet, and I'm the sixth generation away from Thomas Addis Emmet.
We're open for Heritage Week for house tours, and we open at different other different times during the year. But the other thing that we open for is biodiversity walks. We've been an organic farm since the 90s, and now we're looking at how to increase our biodiversity through rewilding, bringing nature back and then letting nature run itself, essentially. And so we offer biodiversity walks to adults, and then we do children's walks as well. We did our first free children's walk back in May, where we collected flowers and looked at birds and examined trees and identified trees, because education is the most important way to, and sort of reconnecting people with nature, because so many people are divorced from nature, really. We're open to the public for house tours, and the house tours sort of comprise of, we have an Emmet gallery, which has lots of artifacts that the family have collected. We have a collection of various things various other things that the family's collected, but it's also the history of the house as well. We have a portrait of Mary Tighe, who would have grown up in this house, and various other things from a, sort of across the history of the house, because it belonged to numerous different families and was also briefly a tuberculosis sanatorium. I'm the fourth generation to live in this house. My great-grandfather moved in here, and for the family were exiled.
Exiled because of taking part in a rebellion. Thomas Addis Emmet had taken part in the 1798 rebellion and committed treason. 5 years later, his younger brother Robert made an abortive attempt at rebellion, which resulted in his execution.
So we're descended from Thomas Addis Emmet, Robert Emmet's older brother, because of course Robert didn't have any children. I do remember being slightly disappointed when my father told me that I wasn't a direct descendant of Robert Emmet, but of his brother. And I thought, that's not as cool. So we're now just moving into the Emmet Gallery. This is a room that we put together in 1998 when the family came for a large gathering. We painted it what we considered to be the Emmet green, and it contains portraits of various members of the family, particularly of Thomas Addis Emmet, the original, when he was Attorney General of New York. The Emmets moved back to Ireland in 1927 and bought this house in 1944. And we were direct descendants from Thomas Addis Emmet, who was Robert Emmet's older brother. And he was released from prison in Scotland after 1798. He was one of the United Irishmen leaders, and he, on the condition that he didn't come back to Ireland. So he went to France for a short period, and then after Robert Emmet was executed in 1803, he rather lost heart and went, decided that they should all go to America, and he went to New York in 1804. So that's really where the Emmets have been until my grandfather moved back. A lot of the Emmets are still in the United States. They still are in the sort of what you might imagine Emmet would be in the law and social justice and environmental. Thomas arrived in 1804. The US was still, you know, in its infancy, and he had a lot of influential help in establishing himself, and they actually became a very successful family there. He was the first Attorney General of New York.
So this is a portrait of Thomas Addis Emmet, MD, who would be my great-great-grandfather. And this is a portrait that always scared me as a child because the eyes follow one around the room. And also it's right, you know, when you're getting out of bed, going down to have breakfast before school, it's sort of right there as you're coming down the stairs. Well, he single-handedly put together the collection of stuff and wrote a history of the Emmet family. So he was vital in maintaining the sort of history being handed down the generations.
It was his son who moved back to Ireland.
My grandfather having moved here, I was born in Ireland and educated in Ireland.
So one of the things that people always tell us when they come on tour is that they really like how comfortable the house feels and how lived in it feels. And it very much is our home. All of the rooms that we show on the tour are used, some of them more than others, but our sitting room, I mean, we use that every day. We have an old heating system, so through the winter we will light the fire in there, watch the television. And then when people come around on a tour, what they see is the massive tapestry behind the television, but it very much is our home. We also need to change our relationship with historic houses in Ireland, because they come with a lot of baggage. I mean, the assumption would have been when I was a child that that I was English and that I was Protestant. And for a lot of the houses, that is true. They were big landlords. The attitudes are changing. You know, they want to be open to the public and they want to bring people in. It's just, it's changing that relationship between the public and the historic case. People think that Robert Emmet grew up in Altidore. He actually didn't. He would have grown up on Siemens Green in a house that was that is now doesn't exist. It's sort of been replaced by the Royal College of Surgeons. It's almost, the house is almost directly opposite where his statue stands in Siemens Green.
The statue shows a young man, his head held high.
It kind of makes him look rather slight.
Frank Aiken had been Minister for Foreign Affairs for two terms, firstly 1951 to 1954, and already a decade in his second term when he spoke at the unveiling of the Emmet Monument. In the period of 45 years from the issuing of the Dump Arms Direction during the Civil War to this unveiling, Frank Aiken had been central to the shaping of Ireland abroad. He represented Ireland at the UN. The League of Nations had ceased to exist in 1946. All assets, library and archives were transferred to the UN, including Hannah Sheehy Skeffington's letter.
In his speech for the dock, Emmet prayed that his memory might serve to animate those who survived him. All who look upon this fine statue will be grateful to the artist who so successfully captured and recorded the spirit of this noble hero. Irishmen will above all be grateful to the man himself who inspired and sustained the generations since his death by his courage and selfless devotion to the liberty of this ancient nation. May the Irish people be faithful to his memory and to the cause for which he died, until a united Ireland can proudly write his epitaph.
Philip Emmet's father attended the unveiling in 1968. Philip did not attend because he was a small child then.
Frank Aiken unveiled it. I mean, I was too young to go to the actual unveiling, but Frank Aiken was there, did. But then my father unveiled a plaque on the house where Robert Emmet was born, and I was there for that with a photograph of me as a little boy. But unfortunately, that building's gone now.
Well, he died at 25, so he never really got to be an old man. I don't see a lot of family resemblance between myself and Robert Emmet, but I do really like the statue. I've kind of grown up with it. There's photos of me at various different ages standing beside the statue, either me and my father, or me and my brother, or just me on my own.
Over the decades, there was an ongoing debate. In Kevin Whelan's words, Emmet was the lively poltergeist in the political system. He says Emmet was used to calibrate, answer the question, how stands the Republic now? What did partition mean for Ireland in 1923 and their participation in the League of Nations and the International Labour Organization?
The problem for the trade union movement is once partition happens, what does the trade union movement do? It's an all-Ireland movement. It's got members across the island of all persuasions and none. So if it takes a position, for example, on an anti-treaty position, does it split the movement? And it also, as you probably know, it hasn't got sufficient credit for this. At different times of the War of Independence, it makes arguments for peace and for demilitarisation. So once that has happened, to some extent, it leaves the movement in a bit of a quandary. The ILO also did try to identify issues that were not just the preserve of what you would call nowadays, I suppose, the advanced Western world, even though in the early days they were the only countries actually directly represented. But they did attempt to look at conditions for, most obviously, seafarers, who by definition are, are global and were often drawn from the poorer parts of the globe. But they also tried to look at what would now be called trafficking or slavery or those sort of issues by way of trying to look at, the movement of workers and try to guarantee that if workers moved, they weren't exploited.
It was also a pioneering organisation in trying to deal with trafficking of women and children for sexual purposes and other forms of exploitation. And in terms of the International Labour Organization, what's remarkable about that is I think it's the first international organization that sets up a particular section in 1930 devoted to women's issues, decades before most countries had ministries of women affairs or anything like that. But it actually has a dedicated women's section to look at women's issues. And it's also demanding that women be included in delegations and that their voices be heard.
Yet Irish women were excluded from delegations going to the League of Nations and the International Labour Organization.
The Women Workers' Union argued that women should have been part of the worker delegations to the ILO or observers. That was rejected by Congress rather haughtily in the mid-20s. Luke Duffy was quite disparaging on the basis that it was already well sending a woman to discuss perhaps a discussion of a gender-related convention. But there were lots of other matters that, quote, didn't affect women. Sort of language that, in a way, would be very offensive today was par for the course at the time.
Women were prominent in the labour movement in Ireland and vocal on women's issues.
So the Women Workers' Union, and particularly through its through Louis Bennett, the secretary, and Helena Maloney, who was a key figure in the Dublin Trades Council, maintained a consciousness of gender-related issues, not just equal pay, but equality in a broader sense, that was quite unique. We're aware of one other women's union of women, for women, by women, at the time in Denmark, but they appear to be the only two women's unions, literally, anywhere in the world. And the reality is that not sending a woman, particularly when there were gender-related issues being discussed, is a black mark on the Congress, who should have really acceded to that. Louis Bennett came to trade unionism through feminism and through suffrage activity, and clearly showed tremendous capacity to organise, to administer organisations, but also to contribute to policy development and to presenting that policy in different ways. So in 1917, when the Women Workers' Union is reformed, she becomes its leader. And until she disappears in the mid-1950s, she died, I think, at 55 or 56. She is the dominant figure. She was highly thought of, and the Women Workers' Union, I think, disproportionately given its size, it never had probably at the max about 8,000 members, punched well above its weight in maintaining women's issues, gender issues, equality issues to the front. If it weren't for the existence in the Irish movement of the Irish Women Workers' Union, originally formed in 1911, but basically reformed and reconstituted in 1917 under the leadership of Louis Bennett, Helen Shenevix and Helena Maloney, there would have been very little, if any, discussion of gender-based issues, despite conventions on equal pay and so on. And in the transport union's case, for example, they employed a couple of full-time organisers. Helen Hoyne comes to mind. Nora Connolly was involved briefly. Mairead Skinner was involved briefly at head office level. So they had some sort of concept. Yeah, I think women in the workforce can be divided before and after the war, First World War. The most obvious ones being that before the war, women were more or less confined to occupations, caring occupations, domestics, child minding, things like that. But also textiles, biscuit making, box making. All of those trades proved to be quite difficult to organise for any union, including the Women Workers' Union, because they were often small scale, very badly paid. There was lots of insecurity within the employment, and therefore, it became difficult for the women to advance, which links us back to the ILO for things like wage boards or, statutory fixing of minimum terms of conditions and wages, because, that meant that the whole of the sector, not just the minority that you could organise, became unionised.
Over 400,000 were employed in services, including public servants, civil servants and teachers.
So the figures are quite small. And within that, Transport Union, for example, in 1920, has about 120,000 members, of which probably 10,000 or less were women. And they were confined to textiles, some clothing workers, some workers in small paper and box making and things like that, jam making. But there was this very small number. So employment was tough to find, and employment for women was tougher to find. we should add to that that, if you like, the first, you could say, direct impact of ILO conventions in Ireland, despite the fact we'd approved of certain conventions, was the implementation of the Conditions of Employment Acts in the mid-1930s. And there's a big debate about that, because by that stage, there was opposition to women in the workforce, certainly married women in the workforce. And there's been quite a lot of discussion of how sexist the interpretation by people like Tom Foran, the head of the Transport Union, and others was, that these regulations actually excluded women. And that was reflecting, if you like, the values of the time. So it was a difficult path for women, and particularly for married women, to access employment, and having accessed employment, to gain equality of treatment within that employment.
The real expansion in women's factory jobs in Ireland comes in the 1930s under the protectionist regime, which is put in place by Fianna Fáil, and a slew of new protected industries are established. And bluntly, it's easier to set up something like a clothing factory than it is to set up a steelworks. So a lot of the jobs that come in behind tariffs are making shoes, they're making the shoelaces, they're making clothing, they're making confectionery, they're canning vegetables, they're doing a lot of jobs where the majority of the workers actually are female. So there's a huge expansion in the 1930s of women factory workers in Ireland, which doesn't go down particularly well with everybody, because Fianna Fáil and the Irish people, and indeed the Irish trade unions, would have preferred men's jobs to be created, but it was the nature of the employment. So you get in 1936, Sean Lemass introduces the Conditions of Employment Act. We always tend to look at it in terms of that it gave him the power to ban women from certain jobs, and or to put quotas on the women in certain jobs. In effect, they were introduced at the behest of the trade union movement. They were never implemented. But there's other parts to that legislation that I think we do need to give much more respect to, because it's a very far-sighted set of workers' protections. It guarantees them the right to paid holidays every year, guarantees them the right to have bank holidays off. A lot of people felt it should be church holidays rather than bank holidays, which, you know, tells you something about Ireland at the time. It restricts, sets minimum pay for younger workers, male and female. In other words, it's actually in many respects a very liberal piece of legislation, which also introduces these restrictions on women. Now, they were never implemented. There were one or two requests from a woman, in fact, to have these particular restrictions applied, and they were just ignored by the department at the time. But I think taking away that questionable side, you have to applaud the other elements of it, which are consistent, and they keep saying this, these are consistent with what the International Labour Organization is looking for.
So there was this notion that by balancing out terms and conditions for workers across the globe, you would prevent unfair competition, dumping from one nation to another, and more importantly, not exploiting other people. For example, the Irish delegation to the ILO, when there were discussions of the reparations on Germany, was very keen to make the point, which was then echoed in the League of Nations, that whatever reparations were impacted on Germany, it shouldn't be at the expense of German workers. So here we had an expression of interest of the majority of the population, the working class, through the Irish delegation at the ILO, that filters through to, you know, global responses to reparations in Germany and how they would affect the German economy. The ILO also did try to identify issues that were not just the preserve of what you would call nowadays, I suppose, the first world or the advanced Western world, even though in the early days they were the only countries actually directly represented. But they did attempt to look at conditions for, most obviously, seafarers, who by definition are, you know, global and were often drawn from the poorer parts of the globe. But they also tried to look at what would now be called trafficking or slavery or those sort of issues, by way of trying to look at the movement of workers, and they tried to guarantee that if workers moved, they weren't exploiting.
This account of the League's policy and work can be picked up on shortwave sets all over the world. Governments and delegations of the most remote countries are constantly in touch.
Whatever may be the details of the constitution of the League, the really essential thing about it is that it represents the first and only practical measure which has been taken by the human race as a step towards establishing the rule of law in the relations between countries.
The League has now 58 member states, 65 international organizations, 22 accredited ministers. The new building is itself part of the publicity program. A message will go from London to Geneva by ship and train in 22 hours, by aeroplane in 7 hours, by radio in less than a hundredth of a second.
Radio remains the best means of international communication and the best publicity for international cooperation.
The world is hearing of the striving of the League in the cause of peace.
But there was this great sense of this was a real honour to be at the ILO and you were serving your nation. And I think that is like people are critical retrospectively. The Congress should have done this. But there was this great sense of we were serving the nation. And it was a new thing. He couldn't serve the nation 2 years before. Like, you know what I mean? Like it's just the sheer psychology of going off to the International Labour Organization, the League of Nations, representing Ireland, you know. So it was a big, big commitment.
I think it's great that we are marking the centenary of Ireland joining both the League of Nations and the International Labour Organization, because they are the first time that Ireland as an independent nation steps onto the world stage and is officially recognised as such and begins to interact with a host of other countries who are part of those organisations. So it's really, really important in both symbolic and practical terms for Ireland. I would also add that I think we've underestimated the significance of the League of Nations and what happens in that post-war period, because it was hugely ambitious in trying to set up global organisations to tackle major challenges facing all the different countries at the time.
So people are always taking Robert Emmet's legacy, whether it's W.T. Cosgrave or Portrick Pierce or other people throughout Irish history, and they use it for their own ends. And I don't think that Robert Emmet would have always agreed with them as to how they used them. I know that there was an article when Ireland reached the quarterfinals of the World Cup that someone wrote a sports article on. Maybe this is the time that Robert Emmet would have approved if for Ireland taking its place among the nations of the world. As an Emmet, I think it's really, really important that we continue to bring a more progressive Ireland into the next generation and generation after that. And I certainly would think that I'm supporting Emmet's vision for an Ireland through rewilding and through progressing education and reconnecting children to nature.
Reflecting on Robert Emmet's words from the dock, "Let them and me repose in obscurity and peace, and my tomb remain uninscribed until other times and other men can do justice to my character. When my country takes her place among the nations of the earth, then, and not till then, let my epitaph be written. I have done." Philip Emmet reflects on the fact that Robert Emmet's body went missing. The artist James Petrie made the death mask in Kilmainham Jail, and thereafter the body disappeared. This meant that his words took on a deeper significance.
So Thomas and Alice Emmet and he came from New York to look for Robert Emmet's grave. It's actually perplexing as to why within the family nobody seemed to know where Robert Emmet had been buried. Well, I think he definitely was buried in Bullies Acre first, you know, on the night of his execution, but he was moved. Some of his extended family went to move him and he was gone. But there were so many unanswered questions, and, you know, at one stage, not so much now, but it certainly was a very important thing.
When I turned 25, which would have been the same age that Robert Emmet died, I had a bit of a crisis of identity, because to think of someone so young at that time dying for Ireland, what had I done and what had I contributed to Ireland in the same way that Emmet did? And now I'm a couple of years on, and now that I'm working with Henry Wilding and also in my other work, I do think that there's a tangential link between what Emmet was doing and what I hope that at the end of my life I will have achieved. Do I think that Rewilding sort of contributes to my love of Ireland? Absolutely, I think it does, because I think we're the generation that has to maintain and progress environmental policies with the ones that we have, but also improving them and continuing them.
Remains were found during an excavation of St. Paul's Church, Stony Batter. They were identified as being in the vault of Dr. Trevor, who had worked in Kilmainham Jail at the time of the execution. He could have been a person who had hidden the body. The authorities would have wished for that. What did the Emmet family think of the lead? Of course, there was no DNA analysis at the time the remains were found.
So my father then later in 1967, I went back to the Trevor vault, but he found that quite a lot of the bones had been mixed up, so that there again he couldn't be 100% sure. But there were other theories that he was buried in Glasnevin, the old Glasnevin cemetery, and in the end he rather liked the theory that Robert Emmet was actually buried in the Emmet family vault on Angel Street. Because Robert's sister Marianne Holmes died within a year of Robert's execution. And she was buried quite late at night, so it would tie in that perhaps Robert, wherever he had been buried, that he was exhumed and reburied in the family vault. However, that gets complicated. We can't prove it, because even in the late 1880s, the Angel Street had been widened and the family vault had been pushed in. So we can't, I think you'd almost have to be an archaeologist to, you know, to make sure whether. But it'd be lovely if he was in there, because I hate the idea of him, you know, being somewhere strange, and at least he would have been with his family. And that's, I think my aunt, who particularly liked that.
It seems the right place to end this series, this decade of centenaries, with the words of a relative of Robert Emmet, whose speech has been used so often during the past 220 years of Irish history. The arrival of Ireland in the League of Nations was a new beginning. During this past 10 years, I have met and spoken with descendants of those active in the campaign of independence. We are all of our time. Some issues that I have seen played out in my generation are passing. P.H. Pierce's words in The Wayfarer come to mind. Will pass and will change. Will change and be no more. For a younger generation like Thomas Emmet, who sees his relationship with Ireland through the preserving of the biodiversity of the land, or those who continue to protest for social justice and rights, I think of Waking the Feminist, whose protest drove change in women's participation in the arts and culture sector. The decade of looking back has come to an end. As for Manol 100, our marking of women's part in our history, I don't see them as ghosts or poltergeists. Rather, as spirits or graces who lend us their understanding by their documents, biographies, oral memory, they have deepened our understanding of war, violence, and the importance of peace. Commemoration is to me not time-fixed. Women's contribution and the understanding of our history as inclusive is constantly changing and evolving. So I leave you with this. Mano 100, Women 100. There will always be a moment to mark, even after the decade of centenaries has come to an end.